Accession number 18802, reel 27.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 27. I think you were saying that on the brigade staff, you reckoned it might take 50 years or so before the troubles in Northern Ireland came to an end.
Well, I mean, I don't think we necessarily were putting that exact figure on it. I was comparing 50 against 15 that people were talking about, and I could see absolutely no expectation that 15 would turn out to be right, and that 50 struck me as a more likely proposition. But I'm not sure I'd even settle for 50, because, and it depends how you look at the thing historically. Do you say 300 years, 500 years, or 800 years is one of those three, or something in between, that the problem had existed? And I think our view was you do not change history across that time span at the drop of a hat in 5 minutes, or relatively 5 minutes. That was our general view.
It sounds like the overall view you had was that the attitudes of all the communities was determined by their history, or by their perception of their history.
Absolutely. I mean, I go back to something I think I said before. I think it must have been October. It was either October 1970 or February 71, I forget which, when Paisley came to Londonderry, and where we'd taken enormous trouble to sort of separate the two sides. And when the little boy, age whatever he was, you know, size about 3 foot or something like that, steamed across the square, breaking through all the barriers of one sort or another, screaming, "Burn the bastards, burn the bastards, burn the bastards." Well, he'd been taught that by somebody, his Catholic parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and so on. And the Paisleyites would have been saying exactly the same about the other side. And so, you know, I reckon it was absolutely built into the system on both sides. That was our observation.
Thinking about that and looking at the current state of affairs in former Yugoslavia, do you think there are any lessons to be learned from the British experience in Northern Ireland that could be applied in Bosnia or Kosovo or any of the other troubled areas of the former Yugoslav Republic?
I haven't really sort of, I haven't been following former Yugoslavia and Bosnia and so on. I mean, I'm aware of what's been going on. I'm not sure that the Northern Ireland scene is relevant. I mean, I suppose they've got their historical and built-in problems. I wouldn't have thought that, I mean, to take the obvious example, that because Serbs on the one hand and Albanians on the other are on the two opposing sides, that's slightly different from Irishmen of the same nationality, but of different religions. I don't think the two things are utterly comparable.
When you were preparing to go back to Britain after Northern Ireland, what were your expectations of your next post?
I'm just trying to think when I was told what it was going to be. I think I knew before I went that I was going to the new headquarters, UKLF, at Wilton, and that I was going to be the DAG. I wasn't quite sure how I would enjoy that and how it would all work out and so on, but, you know, it was a job and to be done, and the new headquarters, quite exciting from that point of view, replacing all the command headquarters that had existed up to that minute and operating direct to district headquarters.
And you had no real fixed expectations of what it would be like. What were your main duties and functions as Deputy Adjutant General?
Well, the MGA, the Major General in charge of administration, he was quite clear about what the A side was up to. He said they're responsible for everybody from the womb to the tomb, and everything in between. It's not a bad definition, really. And so I took my line from him and operated on that basis. But of course, the interesting thing was that the detailed day-to-day work was done by district headquarters. We were sort of what you might call a planning headquarters. If I use the word strategic, it's I don't mean from an operational point of view, I mean from a thought point of view. And on the A side, I suppose one of the things that I contributed most on was the operation of various welfare funds, because we had a call on an army welfare fund controlled by the MOD. We had a call on the Nuffield Fund operated by the MOD, and we had a call on our own funds, which were operated by us. And I was responsible for coordinating bids from all the districts to these various funds. And we had what we call a board of trustees, who were the senior officers of the headquarters, led by the commander-in-chief. And I was responsible for producing papers. I mean, I say I was responsible. I chose to do it this way. Whether it's the correct way of doing it or not, I don't know. But I produced voluminous papers supporting these various bids. And, you know, that when the trustees met, they just went through each bid and ticked it off, yes or no, as a result of which I was able to tell districts they either had or hadn't got what they'd bid for. And we did actually manage to shift a lot of money for a lot of very useful projects.
But what sort of projects?
Oh, everything from cagoules for adventure training on the one hand to a manège for horse training on the other hand, and almost anything in between. Free-fall parachuting, of course, came into it as a not as a duty, but as a recreation.
So it sounds as though it's the support of sporting activity and adventurous training.
It was everything. Sport, yes, generally, provided it was not something that should be organised by the army anyway. I mean, we weren't supporting, say, football, because that was an proper organised unit thing. But we were supporting other sporting things on a general basis, but also more straight welfare things. I can't just immediately think of an example. But money, quite certainly, in quite large quantities, was shifted to the benefit of individual units within the district.
How many district headquarters were you having to deal with?
Well, the awful thing is, I can't remember. I should think it was 5 or 6. I mean, if I sat down and counted them on my fingers, I could probably remember. But, I mean, broadly speaking, there was Northwest District, Eastern District, London District, Southwest District, and then there was Southeast District, which was Aldershot and all that lot. There's 5, and I'd rather think there was one other.
Scotland, perhaps?
Scotland, yes, and Wales, so that makes 7. And it may well be there was a northeast as well.
Who were you working to as a DAG?
I worked to the MGA.
The Major General Administration?
Yes. But, in fact, I was left very much to my own devices. Even though once they met me and so on and realised I was more or less okay and competent, I was left to get on with it. But I reported to him every so often, I met him every so often, and I saw the Commander-in-Chief when I needed to.
Was that frequently?
No. Wasn't necessary. And the deputy commander-in-chief, who was sort of the commander of the field army, more or less, I knew him because, you know, we just met in the corridor and so on, and because I was a member of the headquarters. But I never did business with him at all.
And what staff did you have serving you?
There was a Colonel A, and then, if I remember correctly, there were 3 sections. And I can't remember what they were called. One was a families section, which was headed by a retired lieutenant colonel. The other sections were headed by retired majors. And so we were very much an RO-based sort of organisation. But I did have a Colonel A, who was sort of my deputy.
You mentioned the use of welfare funding and moving funds from trusts down to the district headquarters. But were there any other things that you had to do, get involved with on a personal basis?
Well, I suppose that if there were problems, I mean, if a district had a disciplinary problem, say, they might wish to consult us. But again, it was a district matter on the whole to handle it and deal with it. But I think we had, I think we were used as a sounding board, probably, and I got involved in quite a number of general subjects, but not necessarily personal responsibility.
What sort of general subjects?
That's the awful thing, I can't remember. But, you know, I mean, if one just says, look, the general A side of life.
You are talking about discipline. Did you find that the districts varied in their approach to discipline and in the level of criminality that they reported? Presumably you got reports of courts martials and other
yes.
proceedings.
I don't think I remember one district as, you know, being wildly different from any other district. But of course, South East District being bigger, the biggest, and was a Lieutenant General's command rather than a Major General's command, the fact that it included Aldershot and all the soldiers round about there, inevitably, and Lark Hill and those garrisons, inevitably more things happened there than happened, shall we say, in Wales. Equally, I suppose, when you went to Scotland, you found a few toughies there who offended against various things of military discipline. But I don't think it would be right to say, oh, yes, you know, in such and such part of the country it was much worse than anywhere else. No, I wouldn't say so.
Were there any changes in the overall general policy on discipline while you were DAG?
I don't think so, no. I mean, the general feeling was we all knew what the requirements were. We all knew about the Army Act and, you know, all that. And I think we just expected people to behave as traditionally soldiers had behaved. And occasionally some people misbehaved, but on the whole, the great majority behaved very decently.
You mentioned families. What was the main content of the work there, dealing with families?
Well, there was quite a lot of separation, of course, because, you know, people going to Northern Ireland, people going on unaccompanied tours to wherever. And that created a number of difficulties for individual units, rather obviously. I mean, my own Royal Anglian, for Royal Anglian, when we went to Aden soon after coming back from Borneo, that was a big problem. All the people left behind to look after the families. But I think one of the problems that the headquarters was faced with, and this fellow, this lieutenant colonel in particular, who set up a very good family sort of arrangement, but he didn't really have authority to deal direct with people like Saffa and so on, because Saffa were accustomed to dealing with units and units problems rather than with somebody planning a policy from a headquarters. I exaggerate slightly to make the point, but he, I know, had quite a lot of difficulty dealing with people like Saffa, forces help and so on, really just to get things on an even keel so that he could contribute more than he was otherwise contributing.
Did you have anything to do with the Army Benevolent Fund? Was that also within your sphere?
As a subject, yes. Indeed it was. I didn't actually have much to do with it myself. But yes, it was included in my charter.
You mentioned families and discipline. Were you involved at all with career planning and career development?
I would hesitate to answer that specifically. I think probably no, because I think that was controlled centrally by the MOD. I mean, either the military secretary's side or the director of Manning's side, I think. I mean, I, you know, was involved just on the fringes of that, but I, policy, no.
Do you remember there being any major shifts in policy in any sector of concern to you while you were in post?
No. No, I mean, I think it's hard wet just to sort of go back and say, well, you know, just think of what the A side is supposed to get up to. Well, going back to the womb to the tomb and everything in between. That's what we did get up to. Different days, different things took priority. Usually problems were sorted out at district level. Sometimes they were discussed with us. But I couldn't be specific and say, well, you know, I did X, Y, and Z, because I couldn't say I did or if I didn't.
Did you have a sort of routine working day, keeping office hours, or were you, did you have a less even pace of work?
It, broadly office hours, but I'm afraid, as is my usual wont, the office hours weren't quite long enough, and so I tended to do quite a lot of extra. But that's been my fate through life.
And how was your own work organised? Did you have a PA or some other such individual to look after your office and schedule your work? And
I had a shared PA. Indeed, for the first time in my life, I'd never had a PA before, or anything approaching a PA. I shared a PA with the DQMG, and he and I lived in next-door offices with open doors between us, and she looked after us both. But because I'd never had a PA in the past, and because it's difficult to teach old dogs new tricks, I was not familiar with dictating things, and I tended to, well, I still do, tended to write things down in manuscripts and get them copy-typed. She actually did some dictation, but not for me, because I was incapable of doing it.
You drafted your work in longhand.
Yes.
And then she would
type it. I always have done.
Did you find that she was able sometimes to improve upon your draft?
No.
Sometimes that can happen with a second pair of eyes.
Indeed, no. The answer is no.
At what point did you become aware that this was going to be your last post in the army?
I didn't become aware. There was chat about whether or not I'd become a major general. I was, you know, on the borderline of that. And it so happens that we bought a house in Salisbury. We were living in a quarter in Salisbury. We bought a house in Salisbury because it was about the time that inflation had suddenly begun to take off with the first oil crisis and so on. And we suddenly realized if we didn't buy a house, we probably never would.
This would be around about 1973 then. Consequence of the Yom Kippur War.
That's right. Yes, 73. And so having found a house, we then had to pay for it. And it so happens that my wife's family was very keen to invest. They had a trust fund, and they were very keen to invest in property. And so she was offered a capital sum. We haven't covered this ground before, have we? She was offered a capital sum, sort of no holds barred, and also what you might call an income sum, towards the financing of this house. And it was a very generous settlement. But, of course, having accepted that, one couldn't immediately go to a building society and say, well, you know, we need a second mortgage, as it were, because this lot were treated as the first mortgage. And so I discussed it with Cox and Kings, who people I had dealt with through my job in Wilton, And they put me in touch with something called the Royal Trust Company of Canada, who were very happy to grant us a loan on terms, perfectly reasonable terms. They required, I didn't want to sell, and we haven't got huge amounts of stock exchange stuff, but, you know, savings of several current generations. And so we didn't want to sell that, so we offered it as collateral to this lot. And they said, yes, fine, what we need is this sum plus a third for collateral. So that was fine, so we produced it and handed it over, and that was, it still stayed in our name, but was handed to the bank to, as it were, look after. And so that was all right, and interest rates, if I remember, were about 15% or something, so that was more or less all right. And interest rates suddenly went up to about 19%, if not a little higher. And that was not all right at all. And, of course, at the same moment, the stock exchange, the FT index, was dropping, if I remember, to 450. And so that wasn't all right at all, because not only was our plus a third uncovered, but the actual sum was uncovered. I only tell you all that to explain what happened next. And so I worked it out for myself, and also talking to Cox and Kings, that I said, look, the only way possibly I can solve this family problem without losing savings of generations is, in fact, to leave the army and mobilize my retirement benefits. And so I stumped along to the MGA and said, hey, can I go? And, I mean, virtually at no notice. And they said, yes, you know, give us a couple of weeks or something to sort it out. And the commander-in-chief was very friendly and helpful. And I went. And it so happened that because this, I mean, this was a terrible blow to me in particular, but the family generally. I mean, fortunately, I've been able to solve the problem by leaving the army. But it did mean that looking to what one might do in the future, one's view on priorities as between, on the one hand, job satisfaction, interest, etc., vis security and these other things, I would, in the past, always have put security quite low down my list of priorities, and job satisfaction, enjoyment, and so on at the top. And I would have expected to trot off to some business or other, probably quite a big business in the civil world, and get myself some sort of employment there. But, of course, now that security, etc., had become a top priority, I began to think of something else, and it so happened that the civil service at that time was offering a window of opportunity for people aged between 28 and 52 to join as principals. Now, you know, you had to compete, etc., etc. And so I talked to the command secretary at Wilton, who was a personal friend as well as being the command secretary, and he said, look, take the civil service exam. If you can pass that, you can pass anything. So I said, well, that's good advice. So, in fact, I took the civil service exam at exactly the same time as Anthony was taking his. And there was obviously a great sort of feeling in the family. What happens if Dad misses and son succeeds?
Or anyway, the other way around.
Or the other way around. Anyway.
But do you remember what was in the examination?
Well, because I had been to the Surf College, I was exempt from, I think there was some essay or other that people had to write. I didn't have to do that, but I did a three-day sort of selection board and all sorts of funny little exercises one had to do. And in particular, there was a sort of domino exercise, I remember, which I failed lamentably at. I mean, I don't think I answered a single question out of 20, whereas the word questions and so on I was quite good at. And there were interviews of all sort of with psychologists and God knows who. And the whole thing finished up with what I think was called the final interview with sort of commissioners of X, Y, and Z, who were about five of them sitting around a table interviewing all these characters. And so when I went in, they were very polite, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was the most hostile interview I've ever done in my life. Very good. I mean, brilliantly done. And I think it brought out everything they were looking to bring out. Anyway, they said you didn't do very well on... sorry, I pulled this off. Well, the chairman said, I think I was called Brigadier... Yes, Brigadier Cowan. You didn't do very well on the numbers game, did you? So I said, no, I didn't. I found it extremely awkward and difficult. But I did all right on the words, didn't I? Or words to that effect. So there was a sort of grin around the room. That was all right. So they then said, well, now, would you please discuss hanging? And so I trotted out what you might call the party line on hanging. And I think got it more or less right. And they then said, well, that's very interesting, Mr. Cowan. Would you please now argue the exact opposite? And so it was my turn to grin, because I didn't find that difficult, because, you know, I've been accustomed to doing that sort of thing all my life.
Pros and cons.
Yes, exactly that. And so I trotted out what I thought the contrary argument was, and they looked quite pleased and that. And I can't remember what else they talked about or asked me to talk about. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, I got accepted, much to my surprise, because if I remember, there were 35 vacancies for 1,200 applicants. And so, you know, it was quite competitive. And so I've always said the reason I got accepted is that, I mean, you know, obviously a certain amount of luck came into it, but mainly because I put down the Northern Ireland office as my first choice ministry, which I shouldn't think anybody else put down. And I put it down partly because it was a new ministry. Had only been going for a year at that time, formed in 1972, and partly because it was drawn from all other departments, and partly, of course, because of my own background in Northern Ireland and my wish to do something to help the province. And so all that sort of coalesced into putting down NIO as my first choice. And anyway, that all happened. And I duly fetched up at the Northern Ireland office on St. Patrick's Day, 1975.
And how long had it been in existence when you arrived?
It formed in April 72.
So it had been going for about 3 years?
Yes.
And was it fully formed when you joined it?
Yes. But still very much feeling its way. And interestingly, Northern Ireland departments, very suspicious, because they've been used to autonomy. And, of course, now with direct rule, it was a bit different. But also, interestingly, I think the lot I went to, which was called the Economic and Social Division in London, ESL, I think because I made it my business, partly, but also because of the subjects we dealt with, but I think largely personal relationships. I had a very close relationship with the Department of Commerce, as it was then called, from the PUS downwards, and I had a pretty good relationship with the Department of Manpower, I think it was called, less close because it wasn't quite so frequent. As with Commerce, and also the Department of Finance. Now, all those departments, very important departments in Northern Ireland, but of course quite away from, immediately away from the political side of things, economic and social, and Department of Agriculture, Department of Environment, those I got involved with, but initially not quite so much. And because it was self-evident that we were trying to operate very closely with those Northern Ireland departments. We're not trying to usurp their authority and so on. I think it's fair to say that my division, which wasn't mine when I first started, I was a principal, became my division, was well regarded by the Northern Ireland departments, whereas the political side, the security side, was less well regarded because, to an extent, they were impinging on what Northern Ireland departments